From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. This morning, over the grasslands of Kazakhstan, a parachute softly floating down, a secure landing, and then the hatch of a space capsule pops open and...
Christina Cook, your record holder, she is out. Thumbs up and a huge smile.
Yes, we are seeing it real time. She definitely looks glad to be home.
Home after more than 320 days in space. American astronaut Christina Cook, upon her safe arrival Earthside today, well, she broke the record for the longest ever space flight by a woman. It's another remarkable milestone in human space exploration. I will note, though, the irony that as humankind pushes forward in space, we're still heavily reliant on old technologies like the Soyuz capsule. Various versions of that spacecraft have been in existence since the 1960s, and it is the capsule that brought astronaut Cook safely back home today. But that soon may all change, because as public-private partnerships gear up, private corporations like SpaceX, like Axiom Space, they are all becoming more significant players in the next steps of manned space exploration. So this hour on Point, we'll explore the advantages and drawbacks to seeing profit in the stars. And joining us today, we've got two terrific guests to walk us through this. Ariel Ekblad joins us. She's the founder and lead of MIT's Media Lab's Space Exploration Initiative, where her current research includes designing and testing robots that manufacture or build themselves in space. Ariel, welcome to you.
Great to be here. Thanks, Meghna.
Also with us from Washington is Charles Bolden. He served as the administrator of NASA from 2009 to 2017. He was the first African-American ever appointed to that position. He oversaw the end of the shuttle program for NASA and the beginning of public-private partnerships for human space exploration. He's also a former astronaut as well, a retired Marine Corps general, a consultant at the Bolden Consulting Group, and recently hired by Axiom Space. That is a company that's building a commercial module for the International Space Station. So, Mr. Bolden, it's a great pleasure to have you on the show. Welcome.
It's great to be with you. And just call me Charlie.
Okay. So, Charlie, since you've been up there, let me just first start by asking you, I mean, how is Christina Cook feeling right now after more than 320 days looking down on Earth from on high?
Well, you know, I have no experience to compare to Christina's. My longest mission in the shuttle era was 9 days, so I can't tell you how she feels. I know she's happy to be home because you could see that in her face as she got out of the Soyuz this morning. And she'll have some difficulty just motivating herself around for the first day or so. And you know, the immune system will catch up sooner or later, and her nerve endings will catch up sooner or later, but she'll probably recover to full capacity within the next few weeks.
Yeah, and like Mark Kelly, who spent only, what, a dozen more days than Christina has in space, they are walking laboratories for the long-term effects of space travel on the human body, which we need to know as much as possible before we decide to really head off to Mars. But before we get to sort of the nitty-gritty, again, every time I talk to an astronaut or a former one, Charlie, I just want to know what it's like. What is it like being up there? Is it as spectacular and transformative as it feels, as it seems?
I guess, you know, I would say it's much more spectacular than the pictures portray. We have great cameras nowadays. They're better and better than they ever were before, but they just cannot capture what the human eye sees. God's camera is pretty awesome. The ability to play around with Newton's law, the fact that, you know, because gravity is overcome by the speed at which you're going around the planet, allows us to seem like we're floating. And that's a lot of fun to get to play with, you know, a body at rest stays at rest, a body in motion stays in motion. And for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. It makes all that stuff that you learned in middle school, if you learned it or if you avoided it, it brings it to life for you. So that's incredible.
And even the slightest amount of friction slows you down and it'll pull you back down the gravity well, so to speak. But Ariel, for Christina Cook's accomplishment, I mean, place it for us in the arc of where human space exploration or manned space exploration is going next. Is it a significant milestone?
It absolutely is. It's a huge milestone. Part of her story around the spacesuit and the sizing of the spacesuits and the all-female spacewalk is something that we pay a lot of attention to at our group at MIT. And then being able to be in space for that length of time provides an invaluable sense of knowledge of what is the human lived experience of space. How might we better design for her comfort, to delight her in space, to now, thanks to standing on the shoulders of groups like NASA and Charlie's work, think about not just a survivalist mode for space exploration, but what are the artifacts and the tools and the experiences that we could design for Christina in the future, given her experience of this 300-plus day journey and stay, to really delight her for her experience in space exploration and to, in the future, scale that to space tourists and others besides astronauts.
Space tourists. Okay, so talk to me a little bit more about that. I mean, how close are we to having regular tourism in space?
I would say we're both close, we're dangerously close, and yet so far away. So companies like Blue Origin and Virgin Galactic are racing to be able to send some of the first space tourists into low Earth orbit on some of their crafts in either this year or upcoming years. With Axiom and the announcement from NASA about the first commercial space station to be attached to the International Space Station, we're beginning to build up that infrastructure that could support real space tourism. There are still, as I'm sure Charlie can also speak to, large unanswered questions about how do you prepare someone, if not off the street, a space enthusiast for the experience of space when they're not necessarily going to have the same in-depth, extensive training as a NASA astronaut. How do we keep them safe? How do we handle mental health? How do we prepare them for both the excitement and the responsibility that they might have as a member of a crew in a resource-constrained environment?
Charlie Bolden, should people who aren't fully trained as astronauts ever be up in space?
Yes, without a doubt. And the sooner we can get there where we don't, you know, they've got to have some training. But I would say it depends on what the flight is going to be. I haven't had a chance to talk to Beth Moses from Virgin Galactic, but Beth would be, she's not a normal person off the street because she's the astronaut training officer at Blue Origin, but Beth had an opportunity to fly, and she didn't go through years of training. I think there are some fundamental things that you teach someone about mobility, and don't touch that, and then you let them go.
You know, okay, I'll completely out myself here. You're talking to my inner 12-year-old is still a space purist, okay, Mr. Bolden? Like, I'm still a space purist and thinking that it should be only – this is an avenue of human exploration that should be sacrosanct. It shouldn't actually be sullied by profit motive. It shouldn't be sullied by tourism, that if we are really going to explore the galaxy and the cosmos beyond for the good of all humankind – that it has to be for the good of all humankind and not for the specific pleasure of a couple of billionaires.
And I could not agree more. And that's why we need to get commercial space to the point where the launch cost is significantly decreased, where the time to train or the cost to train and spend time on orbit is significantly decreased so that it's not just billionaires. You know, I always tell people we're going back to the future. NASA did this back in the 80s with the Payload Specialist Program. Uh-huh. And they were not career astronauts. They were people who flew frequently once, and they were selected because of some technical expertise that they had. A friend of mine, Charlie Walker, flew four times in space because he was there with a commercial payload, something that was called electrophoresis operations in space from Johnson & Johnson and McDonnell Douglas. So they come with a specific mission. They're trained for that, and they're trained how to, you know, take care of themselves inside the shuttle or inside whatever spacecraft there is, and then you let them go for it.
Okay. Well, so again, full disclosure, you are an independent consultant for Axiom Space.
Exactly.
And they are building a commercial module for the ISS. Is that right?
They are starting with a single module, and that module will grow into a full-blown commercial space station with multiple modules, a series of solar arrays that provide the power for the station, because it's going to fly, and I'm not exactly sure how long it's going to be docked to the International Space Station. It'll go just to demonstrate that it works and that it's safe, and then it will undock and it will go off and have its own orbit, and it will eventually replace the International Space Station because it's getting old. And, you know, NASA and the partners have agreed to try to keep it going until 2024. Some engineers talk about 2028, but I don't see that as a realistic possibility. So we need to have commercial stations so that we don't have a gap in human spaceflight in low Earth orbit.
Okay, so tell us more about that then. So if it seems as if the plan is to have the next space station be, would it be entirely privately owned? Would there be a relation? What would the relationship be with NASA or the international public space community?
Yeah. You're going to find that it depends on who you're talking to. If you're talking to NASA and the international partners from the International Space Station, the concept that NASA has been promoting is turn over low Earth orbit operations to commercial entities, private, entrepreneurial, academic, commercial entities, and the government organizations like NASA become customers. That's NASA's goal, is to become a reliable partner or a reliable company customer for commercial entities who are running low Earth orbit. If you look at the Chinese, right now, because they don't, they're trying to catch up, actually, their first plan is to have a government-run space station that would be several modules. They've flown Tiangong, which is that's the name for their station, and they've flown individual modules a couple of times now. But I don't think they envision going with a commercial kind of space station. So someone who works with the Chinese would be going to a government-operated space station.
Ariel, we've got about 30 seconds before we have to take a quick break here. But let me ask you, do you think that humanity's big future goals of space exploration, let's talk about Mars for a second, is it possible without commercial interest being involved?
I think it's critical to have both. As Charlie and David Newman, another colleague of mine, have shown, the path from Moon to Mars is going to be a public-private partnership path, and we need the capability that private brings and the inspiration that NASA and that the governments can still bring to the task.
But we are talking about next steps in the human exploration of space, not just machines or satellites, but human beings themselves. We're talking with Ariel Ekblad and Charles Bolden. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com. Code POD.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about next steps in the human exploration of space, not just satellites or rockets, but actual people and where we might go and how we might get there. I'm joined today by Ariel Ekblad. She's founder and lead of MIT's Media Lab's Space Exploration Initiative. And Charles Bolden also joins us as well. He is a former astronaut and former administrator of NASA. He served in that position from 2009 to 2017. And Charlie Bolden, before the break, I was asking Ariel about, is it impossible to imagine ambitious future missions without the private sector? And you sort of chimed in there and you said, we have to have them. Why?
I think we have to have them. A couple of things. Low Earth orbit operation is too expensive and too complex for national space programs to try to continue to own and operate that real estate. They've got to hand it off to the commercial sector and become customers to make it a viable business so that we can go on to places. You know, NASA has a sort of a five-part plan right now for low Earth orbit. They call it their low Earth orbit economic plan. And one of the critically important parts of it is to enable commercial and marketing opportunities on the station while we try to move off station onto private platforms. When you look at the long-term sustainable program for NASA, I can see them using the commercial entities in LEO for astronaut training and adaptation to space flight. You know, you don't want to put somebody in space and have them go right to Mars on their first mission. So you would send them to a commercial station and let them do some experimentation and the like, maybe even come back to Earth and then get assigned on their first lunar or Mars mission. So we're still going to need the low Earth orbit environment, and that's where the commercial entities will really come in. Plus, they're providing the vehicles for transportation. NASA's long been out of the transportation business.
Right.
Charlie, I couldn't agree more, and I think one of the caveats that we want to think about as NASA perhaps transitions to further out long-range inspiring goals beyond low Earth orbit is to how do we retain intentionality in the design of the activity in low Earth orbit? Without NASA or other institutional space actors there as shepherds, can we think almost like an urban planning approach? There are a lot of different analogs: waste management, traffic coordination, zoning, use of utilities like electromagnetic spectrum. What would it take to have not an overly regulated but a coordinated approach to the commercial activities in low Earth orbit so that we don't ultimately find ourselves with a tragedy of the space commons or a challenge in that shared space?
I'm going to be perfectly honest. I am the in-house cynic today, as much as I love the idea of human space exploration. Because, Ariel, I mean, using the analogy of urban planning, I mean, if you were just outside in the streets of Boston, it's a mess out there. I mean, we're not even good at it here on Earthside. What makes you feel confident that we're talking about the whole global community coming together to be able to manage low Earth orbit?
I think that's an example of why it's so needed. So if we were to just say we're going to give up, we're going to let it be a free-for-all, you could imagine all kinds of conflicting issues arising very quickly in this beautiful near-Earth cocoon around the Earth that we all share. So to the extent that we can be optimists so that we can try, I think we have a societal responsibility to think with some intentionality about designing our life in space and designing the multi-stakeholder approach to low-Earth orbit when it becomes this commercial sphere, as Charlie is predicting.
Charlie, what do you think about that? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, Meghna, I don't want to oversimplify it, but I could not agree more with Ariel. You know, the big advantage of space and real estate there is, unlike Earth, where people do strange things and they abruptly go out of their lane, it's really hard for a spacecraft to do that. So when you talk about space traffic management, we have the capability of controlling and monitoring tens of thousands of particles and satellites and the like today because we accumulate fancy name ephemeral data. So we know what orbit everything's in. We know how long it takes it to go around Earth. It doesn't shift orbits. That physics doesn't allow that. Once we know where it is, we can predict where it's going to be years from now, and we can use that to try to avoid collisions and the like. You can't do that on Earth, and that's why Boston looks the way it does and D.C. looks the way it does, you know, because people don't behave.
People do not
Satellites
behave.
Satellites do.
Absolutely. But what if, Ariel, what about when we get to the point where there's a lot of stuff, period, up there? I mean, as we're seeing the continuous development of these private space companies, I mean, we've been focusing on human exploration. We will return to that. But there are also many just, you know, smaller rocket and satellite companies who will be putting a lot of stuff up there for all sorts of customers. I mean, there's already concern about crowded low Earth orbit.
Absolutely. So There's a part of this problem which is mitigation for the problem that we already have. The FAA in 2018 reworked some of their regulation about the restrictions. When you launch something up into space, you need to be able to prove that in certain classes of items, it's going to be able to come and burn up on reentry in the atmosphere and not contribute to space debris. Then there are companies like Astroscale who are already looking at ways to, using nets or other large magnets, gather clump debris that's cluttering up orbits in space, create a mass that's large enough for it to then, again, burn up and be incinerated upon reentry to the surface of the Earth. And then another approach that I think we could take moving forward is a responsibility in the design to have new space hardware be as reusable as possible. Mm-hmm. So this is one of the design constraints that we think about for those robots you mentioned, self-assembly. Space architecture that is modular, reusable, and instead of jettisoning an aluminum space habitat after you're done with it in 30 years, instead, a modular approach could be reconfigured or repurposed into another type of architecture or even a surface habitat.
Right. That's one of the goals that SpaceX is trying to hit with the Dragon capsule, right?
Dragon, definitely for modularity and servicing space stations. With this example, I'm thinking more of the actual materiality of the shell, the architecture, the physical part and pieces, whether it's satellites or a habitat that we put into space, should begin to be designed and architected from a technological standpoint to be reusable or repurposable. Mm.
Well, we are talking this hour about next steps in human exploration of space and the role the private sector is going to be playing in that. All you once would-be astronauts out there, what are your questions for Ariel Ekblad and Charlie Bolden? What do you think about the fact that folks like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos are going to have quite a big influence on next steps in space exploration? I suppose I should throw Richard Branson in there as well. But let's go to Hanna, who's calling from Hope Valley, Rhode Island. Hanna, you're on the air.
Hi. I don't mean to put a downer on this whole thing, but my question is, how is the thought of climate change playing into this whole discussion? I mean, the amount of fuel it needs to get a rocket up there is immense, I'm guessing. Wouldn't it make sense to, you know, stay grounded at least until we have a fuel that's efficient enough that we can use?
Yeah. Hanna, that's actually an excellent question because there's already concerns about just regular airline flights as well. So, Charlie Bolden, do you have an answer for her?
I don't know whether I have an answer, but I'll tell you what's being done right now. There's a company called Sierra Nevada, as an example. They're out of Louisville, Colorado, and they recently or last year signed a contract to deliver cargo to the International Space Station for NASA. Their vehicle is sort of a winged vehicle, looks like a miniature shuttle. And what's one of the things that's taken them quite a while to get their program going is their search for an environmentally friendly propellant, you know, a green propellant. So you see a lot of space companies that are looking at green propellants. They're looking at environmentally friendly propellants. Hydrogen and oxygen are great because they give you water. But we've got to get to nuclear power and we've got to get to ion power and the like, or we're going to, when Ariel talked about mitigation, we've got to talk about prevention. And prevention means we change the propellants that we use, and that's being worked on quite a bit.
Hanna, I think that's a fantastic question. And to add just a little bit of the research that we're doing at MIT, a colleague at MIT, Danielle Wood, one of the faculty labs that my Space Exploration Initiative supports, is looking indeed at the future of green propellants for rocketry, things like paraffin wax or other ways that you could have CubeSats at least powered with a more responsible propellant. And another thing that we should remember is thanks to space exploration that we were able to send probes to Venus and begin to study and understand greenhouse gas emissions, which then came back and influenced and informed our understanding of climate science and the need to take action now to mitigate climate change for the surface of the Earth. I think in the space industry, we really do have an absolute responsibility to also care for the Earth. We should not be promoting narratives about a plan B or escaping Earth or trying to support human life elsewhere when we have this beautiful orb to protect here. And there's quite a lot that space industry actors can do to be active in supporting climate science research and satellites and build this into some of their planning as well.
Mm. Well, let's go to...
Can I add one thing to what Ariel said?
Yeah, go ahead.
I am not a plan B person. If we're looking for plan B, we have really screwed up this planet. And I think human beings are smart enough And we should be industrious enough to figure out a way to undo a lot of the stuff that we've done. We created this mess. We can undo it.
Right. I mean, I suppose Hannah's worry was that with the increased traffic from Earth to low Earth orbit, like could that actually exacerbate the problems that we already have here vis-a-vis climate change? But let's go to Daniel, who's calling from Waterford, Connecticut. Daniel, you're on the air.
Hello. I just want to raise my concerns about the militarization of space. In my opinion, space travel and space research is one of the only things that unites us as human beings. And by creating the so-called Space Force and having plans put in place to militarize space, it sort of is already setting the stage for potentially creating some divisiveness. So I just wonder, is sort of the militarization of space going to increase research and make for better sort of vehicles to get there and propel research, or is that going to be something that is going to hinder sort of humanity's mission in the long run?
Daniel, thank you for that question. Charlie Bolden, you have an answer?
You know, as a career Marine, I'm not a big fan of militarization of space. We've got to be prudent in how we deal with our partners and adversaries. We've got to be smart about how we know what they're doing. One of the things that I've long promoted is collaboration with the Chinese so that we have a much better idea of what their capabilities are. If I'm taking somebody to space with me, I have a much better idea of what they can do than I do by trying to guess. And we're in different spacecraft. We did it with the Russians, with the Soviets back in 1975 with Apollo Soyuz test project. We've done it again in Shuttle Mir and now the International Space Station. I see no reason we can't find a way to collaborate with the Chinese and try to ease some of the tensions that might lead to the type of militarization that we're all really not wanting to see.
But Charlie Bolden, if I may, to be perfectly frank, questions of national security and militarization have been part of the space program from its inception, right? When Sputnik first went up, our concern wasn't necessarily, are the Soviets going to beat us in science? Were they going to potentially beat us in the militarization of space or the conversion of space as yet another battlefield? So, this question's always been with us, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has. And as a matter of fact, when people ask, why can't we do what we did in the Apollo era, it's because right now we don't have the geopolitical imperative that we had back then. Sputnik scared the living crap out of everybody because we knew that if the Soviets could put a satellite into orbit, they could very possibly use it to drop something from orbit, and they had the ultimate high ground. That was the reason that we battled with them to be the first to get to the moon. It's still considered to be the ultimate high ground, space is. But I think that's where you pay diplomats and military people to sit down and reason and come up with regulations and rules and laws and conventions that help us to avoid conflict.
Ariel, do you have a thought about that? Are we headed towards more of sort of the Gene Roddenberry Star Trek type future or my latest obsession, the Expanse kind of future here with space exploration?
So it's interesting you ask. The tagline for the Space Exploration Initiative at MIT is trying to build a real-life Starfleet Academy. So we are definitely in our philosophy more on the democratizing access to space. How can we make this an inclusive future? How can we have an optimistic sense of design in the same style that Gene Roddenberry might have? But even the word Starfleet Academy, to some people, has a connotation of an academy that might have grown out of a military academy. And I can see it continuing to be a point of discussion and a point of tension, as you and Charlie raised. It's always been this question of a combination of trying to keep space peaceful, but then certain geopolitical pressures that could push us into a militarization of space that I think we hope we can all avoid.
Well, let's go back to the calls. Let's go to Andrew, who's calling from Dayton, Ohio. Andrew, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing?
Doing well. Go ahead.
Well, I've grown up around airplanes and been interested in space my whole life. And one of the things I've noticed was before the privatization of space, it was hard to get anything done. There's so many regulations you had to go through and debates and funding and lobbying to get anything done through the government. And when you make it so a company can do it, you essentially cut all that out. You make it lean. The decisions that have to be made can be made then. They don't have to go through round after round of debate and funding and pretty much, I think the future of space is going to be almost all corporations. And whether or not we go the Gene Roddenberry route or, as you say, the Expanse route, I love that show. But I think Star Trek is definitely a good model to go for. Whether or not we turn out that way, I don't know. We've had the militarization of space that hasn't really been public for a long time. The Soviets put a gun on one of their space stations at one point, and that's not very well known. So with that, I'll let you guys take it from there.
Well, Andrew, thank you so much for your call, and it's always great to hear from a fellow fan of The Expanse. But, Ariel, did you have a response to Andrew?
I did. I think it's really important to remember that the rise in success of many of the commercial companies that we are seeing, NanoRacks, SpaceX, Blue Origin, is in large part due to NASA's strategic investment in some of those companies through government contracts and their ability to build up this industry. Through our work at MIT, we are incredibly lucky. In the course of a year, I will have worked with SpaceX, Blue Origin, NanoRacks, and Zero-G, which is the parabolic flight, the Vomit Comet flight provider, all in the course of a year. And what these companies are doing are, to Andrew's point, yes, being lean and agile and providing us these incredible opportunities to, within 6 months of a contract being signed, have our research up there. But they are standing on the shoulders of giants. They're standing on the shoulders of NASA to have been able to make that possible. So I think it's a symbiosis.
Okay. So when we have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I'm going to ask both of you about how we can continue to assure in an era of public-private partnerships that the public benefits from continued exploration of space. So that is what we're talking about this hour. We're talking about next steps in the human exploration of space. I'm joined by Ariel Ekblom. She's founder and lead of MIT's Media Lab's Space Exploration Initiative. And Charles Bolden joins us as well. He's the former administrator of NASA. He served in that position from 2009 to 2017, a former astronaut and retired Marine Corps general as well. And we'll take more calls when we get back. This is On Point.
Do you find yourself searching for true crime podcasts that are different from what you're always recommended? Do you want to make a real difference in the cases that you're following? Well, you're a crime junkie, and I'm Ashley Flowers, the creator and host of the number one true crime podcast, Crime Junkie. There are hundreds of episodes already available, and each Monday we dive into the details of cases spanning from some of the most infamous to those that you have never heard covered before. Listen to Crime Junkie podcast now, wherever you're listening.
Smart journalism, fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about next steps in the human exploration of space, manned, womaned space missions to the moon, to Mars, and I don't know, maybe someday beyond. I'm joined today by Ariel Ekblom. She's founder and lead of the MIT Media Lab's Space Exploration Initiative. And Charles Bolden joins us as well. He's former administrator of NASA. He served in that position from 2009 to 2017. And since we are talking about sort of the bigger and important private sector players here in space exploration, I just wanted to play for both of you a little moment. This is Jeff Bezos, of course, founder and CEO of Amazon. He shared a bit of his own origin story last year at a conference for his space company, Blue Origin. Now, folks out there might know that Jeff Bezos has been obsessed with space exploration since he was a child. So here he is quoting himself from an old high school newspaper interview.
I want to highlight this quote. The Earth is finite, and if the world economy and population is to keep expanding, space is the only way to go. I still believe that. By the way, this is also my version of a misspent youth.
So that's Jeff Bezos, CEO of Amazon. Now, that's a cute moment, Charlie Bolden, and I'll give Mr. Bezos that. But the reason why I wanted to play that is when you – I think that there is a concern, or there should be a concern, that as corporations, private sector groups become more and more important, more and more central even to our ongoing human exploration of space – How can we be sure that the public continues to be beneficiaries of the science and the technology that's developed in the course of these missions? Because that's one of the great things that NASA has always brought to us. It's not just the inspiration of the exploration, but there's a lot of stuff that we discovered, a lot of technologies that got fed back into, you know, life for all of humanity by virtue of these missions. So how can we keep making sure that that happens?
Well, Meghna, I think if you look at NASA's vision, it stated that, you know, we reach for new heights to reveal the unknown so that the things we know and learn make life better for humans back here on the planet. And that's what guides NASA, whether it's in aeronautics or science or human spaceflight. We're always looking for things that, of course, will help astronauts as they go into deep space. But how can we help people here on the planet not suffer so much from some of the diseases that are, you know, with which they're stricken nowadays? We're doing research on things like Duchenne's muscular dystrophy. We're looking at aging. We're looking at changes in the immune system. So there is just a lot of biomedical research that's going on the International Space Station that we want to transfer to the commercial sector. And I think that's where a lot of the low Earth orbit enterprise is going to come. It's actually going to come from people who are trying to find better ways or more efficient ways to make material that can make life better back here on the planet.
I mean, Ariel, I completely take Charlie's point, but I'm also thinking of, we talked a little earlier about how Axiom Space may be making the actual next space station that we have, so it would be privately run. Maybe my question was too complicated. Let me simplify it. Does the profit motive interfere with how much the public can directly benefit from discoveries and technologies created in space?
Having a profit motive through these commercial companies certainly changes some of the paradigm when we're thinking about what it was like with NASA. But when you listen to that quote from Jeff Bezos, what I like and what I see in Blue Origin's plan is they're building a road to space. And this could be, if they succeed in that, along with other companies in the industry, could be transformative. It could be a new economy. It can be new jobs. If they succeed in Bezos's vision of helping Earth become more of a garden planet and we take off-world manufacturing, some of the harsher chemical processes that we currently perform on the surface, if he achieves his vision of being able to take some of those out into low Earth orbit or beyond with asteroid mining, then we do see still a real benefit to members of Earth's citizenry who are still here on the surface. If you look at another example, not just Blue Origin, but NanoRacks, they have sent over 1,000 payloads to the International Space Station. They're who we work with to get our research out there. And that is an opportunity through which they are democratizing access to space and gives a real benefit to more individual Earth citizens here who might want to participate in the future of space and would never have had a chance to do that by going through a more traditional, say, government pipeline to get up there.
I see. Well, let's go back to the calls. Let's go to Derek, who's calling from Columbia, Maryland. Derek, you're on the air.
Hello. I just wanted to go back a little bit to the space tourism. And I guess I see – I'm looking forward to it, and I see it more analogous, Meghna, to commercial air travel where – you know, in the 40s, it was a lot of military, eventually morphed into commercial. And in the early days, it was really just rich businessmen who took commercial air flight, and that changed over the years. And I just wondered if we in the future, if we would have, just like how you have an air traffic control system now with thousands of airplanes in the sky with flight paths, if that would be analogous to having some sort of space traffic control to deal with, as you know, we get into years ahead. Probably won't be in my time, but maybe my grandchildren, you know, would be doing space travel.
Yeah. Derek, thank you for that call and for the analogy as well. Charlie Bolden, what do you think?
No, Derek is more, he's more on point than he thinks. Actually, the U.S. Department of Commerce, one of their charges right now from the National Space Council is to come up with a system of space traffic management and take it over from what the Air Force did before. So we're looking, have been for decades, been looking at better ways to manage traffic on orbit. So he's right on point.
Let's go to Spencer, who's calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Spencer, you're on the air.
Hi. It might be the current political climate and watching how other industries have gone in this privatization. And I'm concerned about The influence that maybe former NASA officials who are now paid to advocate for privatization, as well as the safety issues that come without having regulations in place. And I'm reminded about all the Boeing news lately.
Yeah.
It's scary to me to see that play out in space. And my taxpayer dollars, I would rather my tax dollars go into research and exploration rather than into a corporate bank account.
Spencer, thank you so much for your call. So obviously, Charlie Bolden is one of the people you're talking about, former NASA administrator and now an independent consultant for Axiom Space. So Charlie, would you like to respond to him?
Sure. And I, you know, he mentioned the issue of safety and what we found back as early as 2009 when we started the planning for commercialization of space, moving NASA out of the transportation business and having us rely on commercial entities to get things and people to and from space. We changed the paradigm in NASA's approach to safety. So back in the old days when we owned and operated everything, the commercial sector still built the rockets, but we exercised something called oversight. We ruled with an iron hand. We were there and we told them what we wanted and how we wanted it and everything. And that's what led to the significant cost. When government doesn't allow industry to do what they are very capable of doing. Today with commercial space, we use a system called InSight. And we have people in the plants who are there to answer questions about, okay, is this what you want? They are very familiar with the processes and procedures that the contractors are using. And I don't think we're sacrificing safety and quality at all. It's unfortunate. You know, you mentioned Boeing. That's a corporate, a corporate mindset or a corporate culture that a lot of people will have to work on. But overall, NASA's trying to infuse their culture when it comes to safety and quality control into the private sector.
Right. So, I mean, we could talk about Boeing and the 737 MAX on the one hand, but also Boeing in the world of space exploration, right? They have the Starliner spacecraft, which failed to actually dock with the International Space Station in December of last year. Is that right?
That's correct. And but that is not, while I don't want to trivialize it, that's why we test. And I know you've heard NASA say that. The outcome of that test was unsatisfactory. I think Boeing will admit that. And there are probably things that they should have foreseen so that they didn't have the problems that they have. But almost every company we've worked with has gone through similar types of failures. And we learn from it and we come back with much better, robust systems.
I would heartily agree with that. Some of the learnings from the Boeing issue with Starliner in the fall are how to test, how to still achieve at least partial benefits from a launch of that nature. To the question about the taxpayer dollars, and is that listener really still going to see a benefit to their taxpayer dollars and the mention of exploration for the sake of new knowledge, and are we still going to get that with the commercial companies? I don't know. Maybe it's too early to tell. But NASA's still here. NASA's alive and thriving and are now perhaps more freed, to Charlie's point, to no longer be as constrained just to low Earth orbit and the International Space Station, but to take those taxpayer dollars, explore the surface of the moon, and then move on to Mars in a way that we would want our aspirational NASA to do for us. And I think it's time for them to grow, and that can perhaps be the next domain where we are seeing true exploration for the sake of exploration.
Okay, so you mentioned the moon.
And Meghna, if I can add one thing there. You know, this was one of the sources of consternation between NASA, me as the administrator, and the Congress. Was trying to help Congress understand that NASA was no longer going to spend money on building and owning and operating spacecraft for transportation. We were going to buy a service, and that was going to be far cheaper to the taxpayer. So that meant we were going to be able to use the taxpayer's dollar more efficiently and put some of it that we were using for transportation onto the research and development. And that's what if I go back to what I said earlier about low Earth orbit is too expensive for governments to own and operate and try to explore. We need to put our money into exploration, human and robotic, and provide the support for the commercial sector in low Earth orbit to provide the kinds of support that we need, whether it's transportation, on-orbit facilities, destinations for businesses to go to.
I just want to play another piece of tape here because the moon was mentioned. And back in 2010, Neil Armstrong, none other than Neil Armstrong, the first human being to put a foot on the moon, He actually testified before Congress and spoke about his concerns of private entities and spaceflight.
I support the encouragement of newcomers toward their goal of lower cost access to space. But having cut my teeth in rockets more than 50 years ago, I am not confident. The most experienced rocket engineers with whom I have spoken believe that it will require many years and substantial investment to reach the necessary level of safety and reliability.
It's Neil Armstrong in 2010. Now, Charlie Bolden, it's been a decade since he gave that testimony. Are the companies getting closer to that necessary level of safety and reliability?
I think they are. And, you know, one of the fortunate things in being the NASA administrator was I had an opportunity to, on occasion, to sit down and talk with Neil and kind of hear his concerns. And if you hear him out, he did not say he didn't believe in the commercial sector, but he thought it was going to take a lot of time and a lot of effort because he knows that's what it took NASA going from the old NACA to NASA. It does take time. And that I go back to the SpaceX difficulty in getting their first launch off, the Boeing difficulty in not getting to the station on their first test flight. That it's those kinds of unfortunate experiences that allows us to shore up our safety and quality control.
I just got to jump in here, though, Charlie, if I can.
Yeah.
Point taken. It takes time. This is complex stuff. It's hard.
Yeah.
But it also only took 9 years between 1960 and 1969. And that's because the nation was behind that effort that put Neil Armstrong on the moon. Are we lacking that? Is that what we're lacking in the next steps of human space exploration?
I guess I will differ with your opinion. The nation was not behind the Apollo program.
Okay, I'm still I'm a forever like rose colored glasses.
No. And it's important for people to understand the geopolitical imperative. You know, President Kennedy said, "Hey, this is going to cost money, and we're going to spend it," and we did. And before we even landed on the moon, NASA's budget was beginning to get cut because we were certain that we were going to beat the Soviets to the moon. Mission accomplished, and so let's go on to something else. That's what we cannot do. We've got to stay focused, and that's my fear about going back to the moon and staying there. If we really want to get to Mars, we've got to use the moon as a stepping stone, but don't stay there. I mean, you know, that's where the commercial sector comes in. Backfill government, backfill NASA and our partners, and let NASA and the partners move on out to Mars.
Okay, so we've got about 2 minutes left. Ariel, how close are we? Okay, we're still a long ways from actually putting a person on Mars, but what are the immediate next steps? Charlie talked about it a little bit, but what's the next phase in a future Mars mission?
There are many different efforts in parallel to be able to do this safely for the health of the astronauts on their way there. So how do we plan for the rigors of a deep space mission? What does the food look like? One of the projects we work on at MIT is, can we replace MREs, those delightfully but perhaps much avoided freeze-dried food packages, with fermented food, with a meso, with a space meso, or something that has a similar shelf life, can also improve astronaut gut health and the microbiome. Once you get there, we're still trying to solve the EDL problem, so entry, descent, and landing with the weight of a capsule that actually has humans in it and supplies and not just a Mars rover. Having worked on a prior Mars rover that's actually about to launch Mars 2020, we do still have a ways to go thinking about EDL technology. And then there are all of the challenges of essentially frontier living in an extremely harsh environment, but with the promise of new science and new exploration there on the surface. So many different efforts in parallel.
Wow. So, Charlie Bolden, are we talking 2040, 2050? Do we dare put a number on it?
Yeah. I mean, we've made the commitment to spend the next 10 years on and around the moon in preparation for getting to Mars in the 2030s. And I still feel very confident that humans will be orbiting the red planet in the 2030s and will decide during that decade whether we're going to go down to one of the moons and do robotic operations on the surface for a while or whether we're going to take the bold step of putting humans on the surface of Mars. That's still to be decided. And a lot of the stuff Ariel's working on up at MIT right now, I'm in love with because her, you know, what they find about machines that can build themselves and take care of themselves, that's exactly what I think we're going to put on the surface of Mars to burrow underground and build out the habitats so we don't have to put astronauts at risk in building the habitats. The astronauts will go to the surface and move right in because machines will have prepared the living quarters.
You know, the 12-year-old in me will never stop being thrilled that that possibility may one day happen.
You'll do it, Meghna. You'll do it. Trust me.
Maybe my grandkids. But Charlie Bolden, it was great to have you on the show today. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
And Ariel Ekblad, it was a pleasure to have you as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.